story. A woman who refused to break ties with the banned meditation group Falun Gong was beaten to death by police while held in custody in eastern China. This according to a Hong Kong-based rights group. Zhao Jinhua, who had been following the teachings of Falun Gong leader Li Hongzhi since 1995, was detained near the city of Jiaoyuan on September 27th. Police informed her family Friday of her sudden death without giving the cause of death. Falun Gong members have reported numerous unconfirmed cases of beatings and other maltreatment of group members detained since the government banned the movement in July. With an aye vote of the 1.4 million food and commercial workers in its pocket, Vice President Al Gore's presidential campaign said the AFL-CIO's bigger prize endorsement is all but assured. The AFL-CIO President John Sweeney, who made his desire for the Gore endorsement clear to his affiliated union presidents when they first met on Friday, also sounded satisfied that the votes are moving his way. The United Auto Workers, Teamsters, electrical workers, and perhaps the machinists remain uncertain votes on the question of endorsing Gore now or later, according to labor and political operatives. But these unions don't represent enough votes to block an endorsement, which under convention rules proposed by Sweeney must be approved by unions representing two-thirds of the AFL-CIO's 13 million members. The Executive Council, made up of presidents of the AFL-CIO's largest unions and the full convention of some 700 delegates, vote on Wednesday. Gore made plans for a victorious acceptance speech at the Los Angeles Convention Center after those votes. The AFL-CIO is creating an internet gateway it hopes will connect its 13 million members online and serve as a high-tech organizing device. The web portal site called WorkingFamilies.com is scheduled to be up and running by December 1st, and union members will be offered internet service at no more than $14.95 per month. The AFL-CIO also said it'll offer members discounted computers with full financing for as little as $600. Time is running out on the Clinton administration's push to delay a Senate vote on the nuclear test ban treaty. Opponents led by Majority Leader Trent Lott say the vote will proceed as early as tomorrow unless President Clinton withdraws the treaty and promises not to resubmit it during his term. With most Republicans opposing the treaty, it would almost certainly fail to get the two-thirds vote needed for approval. Relatives of the African-American man dragged to death by white supremacists in Texas believe hate crime laws should cover gays and lesbians. The family of James Byrd Jr. joined gay rights activists in Washington Saturday night at a campaign for expanded hate crimes legislation. Byrd's relatives and Attorney General Janet Reno were joined by the family of Matthew Shepard, a gay man beaten to death a year ago in Wyoming.
To our elders who teach us of our creation and our past, so we may preserve Mother Earth for ancestors yet to come, we are the land.
This is dedicated to our relatives before us, thousands of years ago, and to the 150 million who were exterminated across the Western Hemisphere in the first 400 years' time, starting in 1492.
To those who have kept their homelands and to the nations extinct due to mass slaughter, slavery, deportation, and disease unknown to them, and to the ones who are subjected to the same treatment today.
To the ones who survived the relocations and the ones who died along the way.
To those who carried on traditions and lived strong among their people.
To those who left their communities by force or by choice and for generations no longer know who they are.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. It may officially be Columbus Day in many other parts of the country today, but South Dakotans are observing Native American Day, with several celebrations planned around the state. The holiday was started in 1990 by the late Governor George Mikkelsen in an effort to improve relations between whites and Native Americans. As others talk about Columbus discovering America, here at Democracy Now!, we look at the history and reality of those who were here before Columbus set foot on the continent. Over five centuries after the beginning of the systematic genocide against Native people here in the United States, Native Americans continue to struggle for cultural, economic, and social survival while they continue to be excluded from positions of power. Just last week, as the Supreme Court reconvened, a coalition of groups protested the lack of clerks of color at the court, pointing out that there has not been a single Native American clerk in the history of the court. And the struggle for land continues as the U.S. government seeks to exploit Native land for development, toxic dumping, and other purposes. Even as Washington last week hosted a meeting between representatives of slave laborers from the Nazi and German companies they were forced to work for, the U.S. government is still in denial about its own role in the genocide of Native Americans. The U.S. still refuses to ratify the Convention on Genocide, which would hold it accountable for its extermination policies against Native people and the destruction of a people's culture. In today's Columbus Day special, we bring you a speech by Ward Churchill, a longtime Native American scholar and activist. Ward Churchill is a professor of Native American studies at the University of Colorado Boulder and author of a number of books. His latest, A Little Matter of Genocide, Holocaust and Denial in the Americas, 1492 to the present. Today, a speech by Ward Churchill.
I bring you greetings from the elders of the Catua Band of Cherokees, my people. And I've been asked to frame out the content of my newest book. It's kind of the culmination of a number of themes that I've been pursuing over the last 10-odd years, having to do with the processes of genocide that were integral to what they like to call American history these days, the nature of the impacts of that process upon the indigenous populations of the Americas over the last 500 years and change, and the ongoing aspects of the processes in the world today. But this particular book tries to bring it all together thematically in terms of the history, in terms of the theory, in terms of the enunciation of what genocide means, which seems to be a stumbling point in getting the idea across. The modern aspects of it, whether that be in terms of sterilization of indigenous women, the radioactive contamination of entire population groups and land bases, the most bombed nation on the planet, for example, is Niue-Segovia, the land of the Western Shoshone, which has been subjected to 1,000 nuclear detonations over the last 40 years. The testing of hepatitis vaccines that have been correlated by the World Health Organization to HIV virus, which in turn is correlated to AIDS on Inuit populations on the North Slope of Alaska. These are current events, not historical. But what really provoked me in a way, which provoked me to write what comes to a 550-page treatment of the subject matter, and to release it in one volume so that it would be readily accessible to people, came both as a sort of a culmination of frustration of the kinds of interactions I've had around even using the word over the last 20 years of academic existence, in correspondence with a book that was put out by one of the preeminent Judaic scholars in America, a woman by the name of Deborah Lipstadt, called Denying the Holocaust. That's a very interesting book. The first half of it, I'd say, might well qualify as a brilliant exposition. And she deals with a subject matter which I think is pretty important. It has to do with the resurgence of fascist sentiment and belief on the planet, a cornerstone of which has to do with the peddling of the rather absurd notion, which is gaining credence, unfortunately, that the genocide perpetrated by Nazi Germany against the Jewish people of Eastern Europe either occurred at some level or degree of magnitude far less than is commonly accepted, or didn't happen at all. And she goes pretty thoroughly into the history of that. And she does a methodological analysis of these neo-Nazis. She says, essentially, there's two elements to the process. The first is what she calls the minimizers, those who would try to make the magnitude of the Holocaust to appear to be less than what it was, to challenge the accepted data on the presumption if you can create the appearance and instill a belief in people that what they accepted is true might, to some extent, not be exactly accurate, then you weaken the whole enterprise of understanding, and that opens the door to the next set, which are the outright Holocaust deniers. By the time you're done with the half of the book, you got a pretty thoroughgoing understanding of what the process is, what its intentions are, who's involved in it, why they might be involved in it. The whole thing is laid bare. It's exposed, and that's good, because it's the kind of thing that exists and thrives best under rocks. And if you pull the rock off the top and expose it to light, it tends to scurry away and die. Or at least that's the hope. But then we come to the second part of the book. And in the second part of the book, for no reason apparent to me, Lipstadt sets out to prove that what happened to the Jews not only occurred, but it occurred uniquely in all history. The fate of the Jews was a fate suffered exclusively by the Jews. No other contenders need apply. And to punctuate the point, she begins going through the experiences of other peoples, non-Jewish. The Armenians, for example, somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000 of whom were destroyed in Turkey in 1915, qualify as having experienced a tragedy, but not a genocide. The Ukrainians, who were virtually obliterated in some sectors by the Stalinist collectivization drives of the 1930s, were unfortunate victims of a political process, perhaps. We won't deny the misfortune suffered by the Ukrainians, but nonetheless, were not the victims of a genocide, regardless of the numbers who died, because there was no explicit intent expressed on the part of the Stalinist government to kill every single Ukrainian that they could lay hands on, and presumably they could lay hands upon them all. And ultimately, the tagline on this is that nowhere in this American scholar's treatment of the question of genocide and notion of Jewish exclusivity in terms of the suffering of genocide is there so much as an index entry relating to Native Americans, American Indians, Amerindians, indigenous peoples, native peoples, or anything that you could construe as being the pre-existing population of the Americas. When I was in high school, I was taught, as was every other high schooler in America, that north of the Rio Grande, circa 1500, there were not more than 1,000,000 people in the entire expanse of geography, including Greenland. That was the official truth enunciated by the Smithsonian Institution from 1939 until about 10 years ago. And insofar as it's the Smithsonian Institution, it's official in the sense that it is federally funded. It exists on the basis of a taxpayer subsidy every year. And its existence is funded as a repository, a source of information for all comers whenever they need this kind of data, which is precisely why you don't simply see this in the classrooms. You see it in Newsweek magazine in 1992. You see it in Time magazine in 1992. You see it in the National Review. You see it in the New York Times. You see it on PBS. You see it on CNN. Whatever the Smithsonian holds to be, a particular number or a particular data with regard to Native peoples is what it is that is repeated in the media to condition a population to believe that they understand something about the nature of historical reality. So it is very official. It couldn't be more official if it were something issued across the ocean by Pravda 15 years ago. And since it's a Smithsonian, and since it's official, it's also supposedly valid on the basis of being scientific. And so you need to interrogate some of this data every now and again in terms of its pretensions to science. And when we begin to look at this historical demographic extrapolation, we find ludicrous evidence. Anyone interested in going through the details, I would suggest you take a look at Francis Jennings' Invasion of America, came out in mid-1970s, has an entire chapter titled, I think, The Widowed Land, which deals with how they arrived at this number. But it works something like this. Incoming population in the 1600s along the Atlantic seaboard came in direct contact with existing Native populations. Now, they were unaware that those Native populations had already been reduced by a considerable amount, not entirely determined at this point, but a significant amount by a smallpox pandemic which had been initiated by the arrival of Ponce de Leon in Florida nearly 100 years earlier. And they'd sort of reorganized themselves and recovered from the reduction and were rebuilding their societies. The people who came in as the first wave of settlers or invaders, whichever way you want to put it, were unaware of that, and so they can't not be held as culpable for having intentionally diminished what the population probably was in 1500. But what they did do was count the number of people, more or less, that they were encountering. And so you arrive, if you aggregate the numbers from the reports that come from those initial newcomers, with an overall population estimate for the Atlantic coast. But a couple generations go by and things have changed. At the beginning, there's a pretty small number of colonists and pretty large number of native people. 60, 80, 90 years later, there's a relatively large number of colonists. Their numbers have increased considerably, and there's a virtual absence of native people. And in that context, the colonists begin to put together the rudiments of what they like to call civilization. They begin to deal with educational enterprises, literary enterprises, and so forth. Among those enterprises is history. So your first rank of American historians does aggregate the numbers, looks at them, looks around, says this can't be right. There couldn't have been that many Indians here. Well, our forefathers were probably prone to exaggerating. Not entirely clear why their forefathers would have been prone to exaggerating, but they just assume as a matter of faith that they must have, and they cut the numbers essentially in half. And a couple generations after that, a new revisionist school of historians arises, and they look at their predecessors' histories and they say, that can't be right. There couldn't have been that many squalid Stone Age hunting and gathering savages inhabiting the forests along the Atlantic coast before the English arrived to cut down the trees and teach them how to do agriculture. So they cut them in half. And a couple generations after that, they cut them in half again. This happens four, maybe five times, the development of what they like to now to call American history. Till ultimately in the late 19th century, you have James Mooney run around aggregating all the historical data from Palfrey and others that he can find. And he advances what he's at least honest enough to say is a tentative and incomplete estimate of about 1.1 million people for the entire continent.
Ward Churchill, professor of American Indian Studies with the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, in a recent speech on a little matter of genocide. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with this Columbus Day special and Ward Churchill in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the speech on the history of Native America with Ward Churchill, he's the author of A Little Matter of Genocide, Holocaust and Denial in the Americas, 1492 to the Present. He's also a professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. Ward Churchill.
Now, he's a star for the Smithsonian, so they published this posthumously. Now, he doesn't make a pretense, incidentally, that this is especially scientific. This isn't based on field investigation. This isn't based upon any research more meaningful than going to the library, reading the current histories, taking the population data region by region that's advanced in the histories, making a column and adding them up. That's exactly what he said he did. You got another bunch of guys out at the University of California, Sherburne Cook, Carl Sauer, others, who are interested in Mesoamerica. And one of the things they're interested in, how many people were in Mesoamerica at the time Cortez arrived. And they develop a method for that. It's probably not a perfect method, but see if you can follow it and see if it's not meeting of the terms of scientific inquiry in your mind. They did what I'd have to call agricultural archaeology. Funny thing to engage in when you're dealing with hunter-gatherers, agriculture. Excuse me, if there's any anthropologists in the room, I know I'm supposed to call it horticulture when it's native people. Everybody else gets agriculture. We get our own special classification. Well, horticulture or agriculture requires soil and acreage. It involves the growing of crops. So they knew what crop types were under cultivation in Mesoamerica. They could tell both from aerial photography and from priest records and so forth, the quantity of acreage that was under cultivation. They knew the relative degree of fertility of the soil because, of course, the soil was there. And part of the record also has to do with the meteorological weather conditions. So now you've got all the ingredients to be able to compute on the basis of the known crop type, soil conditions, weather conditions, and so forth, the average yield per acre of the crops. Multiply that by the acres and divide it by how much would be consumed by an individual human being, and you can extrapolate a population total with a fair degree of accuracy. They've been estimating in the Smithsonian that the Mesoamerican population at the time of Cortez's arrival was somewhere around 5 million. After Cook and his friends got done, it came to 30, which they still have to admit. The island of Española, where the Smithsonian's estimate, and they still say this in Newsweek, at least as recently as 92, was somewhere around 45,000, based upon the same sort of investigative techniques, yield a maximal population somewhere in the vicinity of 8 million. No, they didn't say there were 8 million people in Española when Columbus arrived. They simply said on the basis of the agricultural complex that existed there, there could have been that many people. Bartolome de las Casas, who, far from being a revisionist, he was referred to in Newsweek magazine, was actually the first historian in the hemisphere of a European persuasion, and he was there at the time, said it was probably somewhere in the order of 3 million, so you've got a population bracket of 3 million to 8 million, which was reduced to zero in 75 years, a little different from reducing a population of 45,000 to zero, although I will not concede that it was okay to reduce the 45,000 to zero either, but it's a little more impactful when you start talking about millions of people simply disappearing in a little over a generation and a half. Well, you've got a guy by the name of Henry Dobbins who takes those techniques and applies them to his area of interest, which is, for whatever reason, Temecuan population in North Florida. And he uses the priest's mission records and so forth, goes through the same process, and for Temecuan, which is essentially the Florida panhandle alone, comes up with about an 800,000 population. Panhandle of Florida, in other words, based upon a scientific investigation of what the demography probably was, had a population as great as what the Smithsonian was admitting for the entire continent. He aggregated the data for the Piedmont Plain, which is roughly the coastal area from Florida northward to Virginia, came up with 1.3 million there. Ohio River Valley, 800,000. To cut to the chase on this, he comes up with a maximal continental population of 18.5 million, circa 1500. He's actually raised it a bit since. You got a Cherokee demographer, Russ Thornton, who's trying to make his bones in academia and be all respectable and responsible. He says, well, there's a number of culturally mediating factors that Dobbins doesn't take into account in his formulations, ecological, spiritual understandings, and so forth, that would indicate that native people would not be likely to absolutely saturate their arable land base with people. And that's probably true. So he recomputes, factoring these things in with a certain weight, reduces Dobbins' estimate by a third to around 12.5 million. I think he erred a little side of conservatism trying to impress his counterparts in the anthropology department, which he didn't, okay, because he still got an estimate 12 times of what was the prevailing norm at the time he was doing his work. So you got a 12.5 to 18.5 million general bracket for a population at the onset if you actually use scientific standards to do an assessment. little different than what has been the official truth here. It's a little bit different than the portrait you get of what happened in North America when you use real numbers. The realest you're likely to get, absent being able to step into a time machine, go back and do a census in 1500, which nobody's going to be able to do. But we do have a census from 1890, and here's where the difference begins to take hold. If you use the Smithsonian's 1 million figure and peg it against the 1890 census, where they actually went around and counted Indians, you had a little under 250,000 surviving people in the 48 contiguous states area, which makes for about a 75% population reduction. Just round the numbers off. And that's roughly comparable to the high-end impact in the estimates of Jews in Eastern Europe. But it's an altogether different matter when you start getting into 12.5 million, 15 million, 18.5 million people at the outset, isn't it? The real interesting thing about those numbers is it doesn't matter much at all which of them you want to pick. You can be a radical like Dobbins and go for the 18.5 because you want to make the maximum kind of propaganda statement, as they like to call accuracy. Or you can be a conservative like Thornton and go for 12.5, or a nice middle-of-the-road type like myself at 15 million. Doesn't matter a bit. You're still going to end up in the upper 90th percentile population reduction. If you go to 12.5 million, you get a 96% reduction. If you go to the 18.5 million, you get 99% reduction. If you split the difference and go with 15 million, you get somewhere between 97 and 98. Now, I got another motive for selecting that 15 million, the middle of the road, the 97 to 98, because in the 1890 census, there's a little caveat by way of a footnote on page, I think, 17 of the thing. And basically what it says, of the totality of the land base, 100% of the land base, which was in Aboriginal hands at the beginning of European settlement, approximately 2.5% remains. They're talking about the reservations. Well, last time I did grade school arithmetic, if I took 2.5% away from 100%, I had 97.5%, and 97.5% is directly between 97 and 98, and you've got a perfect correspondence, and I think that correspondence has an amazing explanatory power, because it would be ludicrous to suggest that people were getting on boats in Europe, traversing the Atlantic Ocean, enduring the hardships of the so-called New World for the express purpose of killing Indians. They weren't getting on the boats in London and coming over to kill Indians. They weren't getting on the boats in Spain or Portugal or France or the Netherlands to come over and kill Indians. They came over here for land. In some cases, they came for the resources in or on the land, but that comes to the same thing. To get to the resources, you got to have the land, and it didn't take Einstein 15 minutes to figure out that in order to get the land, you got to get rid of the people who own the land. So the people were liquidated in order to open up the land. In order to open up the land, they ultimately had to liquidate the people. Well, that's a thesis to a certain point. Now, I run into James Axtell at American Historical Association, meaning along about 1993, where he's explaining that none of this is true. And it's only irresponsible people trying to cater to political advantage with the federal government or whatever who are using terms like genocide. We end up in a debate on the issue in the middle of, he's indoctrinating a group of high school teachers on how to teach their students about American history, okay? And we're going around in circles about this, and he finally says, you know, I've read everything there is to read on colonial America, and I can't name more than 5 instances in which genocide would be a correct characterization of what occurred, and 3 of those were French. Well, I'm like that, ready to bounce back. Man, I got him now. And I didn't get a chance. A high school teacher jumps up and says, well, if you can name 5 instances, why aren't you talking about the genocide then instead of denying it? You trash and graduate students for using a term that you yourself acknowledge that at least some cases is correct. Yeah. Well, we can't even agree, I said, on how many people there were. He said, for the sake of the argument, I'll accept your number. But just in order to be able to get through with this, I'll accept your 15 purposes of argument. Note what the scientist just said. I don't know how many people there were, but however many there were, 75% of them must have died. There's a scientific proposition if I ever had one. So, okay. Trivial, collegial, scholarly discussion, I accept it as 75%. And then, so what? The dummy part comes out in capital letters. Because it was disease, he says. It wasn't intentional. It was unfortunate. We had a virgin soil environment here with people who had no immunity to the pathogens that were being introduced. You can't hold them responsible on disease as opposed to gunshot, stabbing, burning, things like that. So that's very interesting. Because my reading of the 1946 Nuremberg Tribunal proceedings indicates that the tribunal was convinced, rightly or wrongly, that probably the majority of the people that died even in Auschwitz died of typhus rather than of being shot, gassed, beaten, clubbed, burned alive, or whatever. And the tribunal held correctly, in my opinion, that the people who worked in the camps were just as responsible for the deaths by typhus as they were for the others, because they had created the conditions in which the epidemics could occur and have such an incredible impact upon the people housed there. So that may be true, but you're comparing apples and oranges. Because whatever else can be said about the concentration camp guards, and I'm not going to say anything good about them, this is Axtell talking again, they were 20th century men. They knew about epidemiology, at least in the most rudimentary sense. They had a sort of understanding of how disease is communicated. They could be held accountable for actions that would not apply to Christopher Columbus in 1492, because they had no scientific understanding at all of disease. They didn't even discover bacteria, much less virus, until the late 19th century. And so you cannot apply the standards of Nuremberg to the conquistadores, or to the Jamestown colonists, or to Massachusetts Bay, or to any of the rest of what you're talking about. It's a false analogy. How does that apply to Columbus and the process that we're talking about? Well, it goes like this. You go back and you assess the evidence. The evidence comes in the form of governor's reports, military reports, settlers' correspondence, diaries, and so forth. There's copious archival material on this. And you look first to determine whether or not people were aware of the cause and effect reality. Okay? And it's remarked upon repeatedly. There's this really pronounced phenomenon occurring. We come, they die. Okay, they got that in mind. Now, how do they react to that? Well, first, they almost universally attribute it to the intervention of God, the hand of God intervening in worldly affairs, clearing away something inferior, even akin to the devil in some instances, depends on the interpreter, to make way for a chosen people. You sort of hear a little prefiguration of a German orator of the 1930s here. Clear away the Untermensch, make way for the master race. And after 20-odd years of looking, nowhere have I found a single recommendation by a single responsible authority saying what's happening is horrible. I strongly urge the Crown suspend or curtail further contact till we can figure out exactly what it is that's causing this effect and get it under control. No. The recommendations which are followed in virtually every case where there is a profitable potential involved is that the rate of contact is accelerated. More of us come, more of them die, in other words. And I would submit on its face, for historical analytical purposes, this is prima facie evidence of the intentionality which will go into a genocidal process. But just in case, it's still floating around a bit too ambiguously for some people in the room, we can tack it down just a bit more tightly than this. There's a number of prior instances where you can't quite find the smoking gun. You've always got to have the absolute proof before the deniers will concede that you have this anomalous situation on your hands. Well, here's your anomalous situation. 1836, Upper Missouri River, United States Army. Mandans have figured out how to place themselves as a sort of a broker for trade between Northern Plains tribes on the one hand, United States representatives on the other. They're making a profit at it. The Army, not being entirely dull-witted, figures out if you can eliminate the Mandans, you can increase the profits by trading directly with the other Indians. Request goes downriver to St. Louis for a boatload of blankets taken from smallpox infirmary in St. Louis. This is one of those great murky areas of interpretation of American history. Well, you can't find an order that says specifically, let's kill them this way. And of course, it's not in the late 19th century yet, so they don't know about smallpox virus. So we can never draw a conclusion, and that's the historical consensus. And I say you've got to be brain dead not to be able to draw a conclusion on this basis. First, because whether or not they were aware of the virus, they were certainly aware of quarantine procedures. They were aware of inoculation. The British had been inoculating against smallpox since the early part of the 1700s. By 1803, the entire U.S. Army has been inoculated. There are serums for inoculating the Indians in the infirmary of the fort, which had never been utilized.
Professor Ward Churchill teaches American Indian Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. This speech, A Little Matter of Genocide, will continue here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Columbus Day Special. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the speech of Ward Churchill, he's a professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder and author of the book A Little Matter of Genocide, Holocaust and Denial in the Americas.
They understand the principle of quarantine, certainly. That's where they got the blanket, was from a quarantine smallpox infirmary. And when the Indians first began to show the early symptoms of smallpox, it's not one of their diseases. It's not something that their medical practices are prepared to cope with. They have not encountered it. They've heard of it, and they're scared of it. But they don't know how to treat it. It's a white man disease. So what's the logical thing to do? You go to the white man doctor and see how to treat the white man disease. And what does the white man doctor tell him to do? Run. Scatter. Seek sanctuary in the villages of healthy relatives. And that is on record. Unleashing a pandemic that runs for the next 15 years from the Blood Confederation of Southern Canada all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. And how many people died in that one? Well, like I said, it depends on how many people you're willing to admit were there. Smithsonian again says at least 100,000. However many there actually were, it made it very much easier for the United States ultimately to consummate its conquest of the plains where we're sitting right now. But I will concede that not every epidemic, not every pandemic was maliciously induced. but I know for a fact that some of them were, and the fact that some of them were totally eliminates the notion that disease liquidation is somehow or another a benign explanation for the disappearance of not a few hundred thousand, but rather several millions of Native people. And that carries connotations of genocide that a grade schooler could understand. And now that we're done with the 75% of the population and the disease argument, let's turn to the 25% of the population that that 75% was intended to mask. Let's divert it all over disease and discuss whether or not there's an intentionality involved in disease forever after. Amen. I want to get back to the 25% of 15 million dead people who didn't die of smallpox, typhoid, cholera, the flu, the measles, or any of these other pathogens that were not, by any stretch of the imagination, inadvertent, tragically, unintentionally dispensed with. Where did they go, and how did they go there? Well, they went there in a number of ways. They went there on the basis, for starters, of a scalp bounty that was paid as a matter of official policy for the body part, top of the head, of Indians, any Indians, in every colony in North America, every state of the Union, and every territory, no exceptions. That's an across-the-board situation. Scalp bounty, every single location where there was Indians until there were no Indians to put scalp bounties on. They paid X amount for the scalp of an adult male Indian. They paid Y for the scalp of an adult female. And they paid Z for scalp of a child under 12. They paid, in Colorado, for scalps taken from fetuses ripped out of the stomach of women down at Sand Creek. They paid, because that constitutes a child. This is John M. Shivington, erstwhile Methodist missionary come colonel in command of the Colorado Volunteers, put it to his troops, kill and scalp all big and little. Nits make lice. Well, that's fairly clear. Shivington always gets credit for that statement. He didn't make it up. Come from a professional scalp hunter in California. And one of the nuanced technical defenses that's put up on this is it was never a federal policy. Really wasn't U.S. policy because it was never a federal policy. Each of the states, each of the territories did it, but the federal government did not officially proclaim a scalp bounty. And that's a matter of utter irrelevancy because they did nothing to intervene to prevent the payment of scalp bounty on the one hand, and in California and probably other places as well, the state paid out the bounty and then the feds reimbursed them for it. Go a few years down the road and you get Matt Anthony Wayne's journal talking about burning 50 solid miles of Shawnee cornfields in order to bring them into military submission by starving them so that they could place them on a reservation and teach them how to farm. There's something that's intrinsically incomprehensible about a mentality that could arrive at that conclusion, but this is standard interpretation in American history and anthropology. Well, the Indians who came with the corn, the beans, the squash, the pumpkins, and all the rest of it in 1620 were in part Pequot. And Pequot was one of the smaller groups in the area. It was kind of resistant to the idea that that reservation that had been created for the Plymouth colonists ought to be expanded to leisure of the colonists right on into Pequot territory. Now you had larger groups, Wampanoags and such, in the area, but Plymouth decides to make an example of the Pequots. In 1637, they do this by marching an expedition around the Pequot combatant village to attack the non-combatant village in the rear at a place called Mystic in Connecticut now. They totally surrounded it in the dead of night, and then they torched the place. And when people came running out of the flames trying to escape, they had themselves a contest to see who could cut the most pieces, mostly with broadswords and axes. A few were shot. But basically, they hacked 800 people to death, those who were not driven back into flames to burn to death. And the accounts in Jubilation, written by Cotton Mather, depicts these guys dancing in the midst of the flames, waving body parts over their head in an act of Christian, I forget what he said after that. So thoroughly eradicated were the peacocks thought to be by the forefathers for whom we're supposed to give thanksgiving, these homicidal maniacs that went out and utterly exterminated the people who saved them from starvation within 17 years of the event. So thoroughly eradicated were the peacocks thought to have been that the very word was officially by law abolished. You could draw a fine for saying the word peacock. The town of Peacock became New London. The river Peacock became the Thames, names that still pertain in the maps of Connecticut. And that's as utter an eradication as it's possible to achieve. There can be absolutely no question whether the criteria of genocide were met in terms of the intent of colonial policymakers as well as troops in that period. We could talk about the defeat of Tecumseh and how the good old boys from Kentucky turned his back into razor straps. We could talk about the Sullivan campaign against the Senecas, the end of the American Revolution, and how the Rangers that were attached to his unit were wearing leggings made of Indian skin that they'd tanned. We could talk about Brady's Rangers down in the Ohio Valley at about the same time adopting the same practice, wearing human skin garments. We could talk about how it was at Horseshoe Bend when Andrew Jackson suddenly got famous and propelled into the White House. He slaughtered about 550 Creeks, but wasn't sure of the body count, so instructed his troops to go back and cut off the noses and carry them in bushel baskets to someone who was more properly schooled than any of the men that he'd placed in the field. See, taking ears in Vietnam wasn't something new in the American military tradition. Started with noses, started with scalps. The scalps came as a British practice from Ireland where they took whole entire heads. It's not an Indian tradition, at least not in its commercial systematic application. It's a European tradition that we got blamed for all along. We could talk about Sand Creek, not too awful far from here. We could talk about Wounded Knee. We could talk about Slim Buttes. We could talk about the Marias River. We can talk about every village in Northern California being many mystic massacres, and that's in the official California history. They even acknowledge it. What you got is, any way you crack it, a history of genocide, pure and simple. But what's the implication of that? The implication of that really comes to this, as an old man put it to me on Pine Ridge once, Matthew King. The agents called him Noble Red Man, he called himself, just to poke fun at the white guys. He said, basically, you got to look at time the way you would look at space in a journey. If you're going someplace you've never been, where there's not roads and street signs, you got to look over your shoulder every once in a while to orient yourself to where you just came from in order to know where you are. And in knowing where you are, you can figure out where it is you need to go. Well, you all are real concerned with figuring out how to make a better future. You can't make a better future unless you understand where you find yourself, socially speaking, environmentally speaking as well, but at least in your relations with one another. And you can't possibly understand where you are unless you understand the nature of process that brought you here. So you can't look at the past as something distinct from projections into the future as something irrelevant to your understanding of the present. All three of these parts are intimately connected. Those dimensions in space are just as important as they are in dimensions in time, and those dimensions in time are just as important as they are in space. Now, he didn't put all that last part on there, okay? That's taken something that was said very simply and correctly and amplifying it into an academic environment. Okay? You got to call things by their right name, and you got to look at denial as exactly what it is. Denial's one of two things. It's a lie, or it's a psychological pathology. And very often it's both at once. And when you got a pathology of lying occurring as a cultural context, you got a society that's sick in a way that can be rectified simply by injecting the truth. Take the truth and use it as a weapon. And the weapon ultimately provides knowledge, and knowledge provides you with power, and power provides you with a way to be free. Power in the real sense, power in the way we traditionally always understood power, not power in the sense of guns, not power in the sense of that 20 minutes worth of no signs you've got to read before you come into this free building here. Okay? Not those rules and regulations. It comes with your understanding of your place in the process of your existence and your relationship to the other elements of the natural world with which you cohabit must mutually exist. That understanding of the past would allow us to understand the implications of the fact of that sterilization program that I was talking about. When in the 1970s, the Indian Health Service secretly and involuntarily sterilized up to 42% of all American Indian women of childbearing age. Didn't hear about that one in college lectures, eh? That field testing of hepatitis vaccines on the North Slope, which when the Inuits found out through the Circumpolar Conference, they went absolutely ballistic. Well, you couldn't do this thing when it was exposed to the light of day, so they promptly removed it and brought it down to the Pine Ridge Reservation. They were going to inoculate school children there. Wrong place to try it. That was probably the most politicized and conscious reservation in the country 10 years ago. Maybe still is. Maybe other reservations have come up. Maybe it's diminished there, but it was the wrong place at the wrong time. They didn't even get it off the ground there. Moved it over to Cheyenne River. Wrong move again. Everybody on Cheyenne River is related to people in Pine Ridge. They knew about it before they even set up shop. Last I heard, they were up at Salish Kootenai Blood, the northern tier reservations, trying to inoculate children there. In every instance, it's native children. Genocide is not something relegated to the past. Genocide is an ongoing reality. You've got to be able to understand the nature of the process in order to recognize when it presents itself in concrete terms, and only in the recognition can you devise ways and means of heading it off. And it's in everybody's interest to head it off, because it's like a cancer. A policymaker, an individual, a government, a corporate entity, a whatever, that's willing to engage in genocide against any group ultimately is willing to engage in genocide against every group, so long as it meets its own perception of interest. No population is expendable for purposes of profit. No population is expendable to genocide for any reason, and genocide itself needs to be properly understood. So that's where I want to end up, is with an articulation of what the term actually means. Because I've been following in kind of the conventional form, talking about piles of bodies. And piles of bodies certainly has something to do with it, but that's hardly the end of the definition. In fact, if it was just about mass murder, if it was just about pile of bodies, there would have been no need for Raphael Lemkin to coin the term in 1944 to explain what it was the Nazis were doing in Europe. If it was just mass murder, it didn't need a term because they already had that term. They already understood mass murder, and they already understood it in terms of it being criminal. Genocide, then, is on the face of it, right from the get-go, something else, or at least something more. And if you look through the text in which the term is in fact coined, it's a book very little read now, called Axis Rule in Occupied Europe. You find a chapter, it's just titled Genocide, page 73, the first page of that chapter. He makes it clear what he's talking about. Genocide is the intentional, policy-driven destruction of an identifiable, targeted human group as such. Ultimately, a genocide can be perpetrated even if every individual member of the targeted group survives.
You've been listening to Ward Churchill, professor of American Indian Studies with the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder and a member of the American Indian Movement for the last 25 years. He has been leader of the Colorado chapter for the last 15 years. And that does it for today's show, Democracy Now!, produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director.
Rockefeller Pledge. That is the cassette of his speech, the speech we were listening to earlier. 818-985-5735.
And what is this battle about?
It's right next to Fort Snelling, the first fort in Minnesota. And that's built right on what Mendota means in our language is where the waters meet. And to us, it was our creation stories came from right here. And what there's left there in Minnehaha Park, it's the first state park ever in this country, they're going through that park with an unneeded road. And at the end of this park, closer to Fort Snelling, is a spring called Coldwater Spring. And the spring's been running for 9,000 years, and there's 10,000 gallons of water a day comes out of there. And this area, because of these three different water sources there, with the waterfalls of Minnehaha, it was sacred to our people, of course. You know, it's the only river, only waterfall on the whole river basin. And our stories come from there. And there's a green space that's left that they plan on destroying that was a burial place of our people and our ancestors.
Jimmy Anderson, can you describe what has happened over the last week?
Yeah, a week ago, they came in, a month ago, they came into the north end of the park and started to build what they're calling a land bridge, and they started destroying trees. And there's one huge cottonwood tree that's maybe 300 years old that sits right next to the creek there. And our people have been up in that tree protecting it. And that day, they were closing the road down to one lane, so we knew that that tree was probably going to be going. So seven people got up there. And the police came, and they started to arrest people on the street trying to stop traffic, and some people had locked down to dump trucks because they're supposed to be monitoring this court-orderly by a judge. It was court-ordered to monitor the ground for any of my relatives' bones or any artifacts that they might find, and they haven't been doing any of this. So we tried to stop them from both cutting the tree and doing that, and they started to cut the limbs off the tree with the people in the tree. One of our young brothers, he's 16, was on a line that went across. There were three lines, and one of them was hooked to one of the branches, and he was hooked to that line when they cut it off. Luckily, it hung up in another branch and didn't pull him down. We were able to get another rope to him.
And so what's going to happen today, perhaps, in the next few hours?
Well, right now they have seven state highway patrol right underneath that tree like wolves waiting for the last rabbit. Three people got taken out of that tree or jumped onto heavy equipment that day that were cutting the branches and were arrested. Another few came down. There's one woman left, Nettles, who's the strongest woman you could ever meet. She's still up there. She's been up there a full week now today. Last night we tried to... yesterday we had some Catholic nuns ask if they could bring food and water to her, and they were refused. So last night we tried to get one of our people to relieve her by going up and letting her come down and get arrested. And we had her all the way to the tree, and she slipped going up, and they got a hold of her. So she was arrested, too. So we haven't been able to get water or food to her for a week.
Do you expect a police raid right now?
Right now has been what they've been doing is a lot of these guys are Vietnam vets and they're using those tactics to attack the trees because we can't be in every tree along there. There's probably 1,000 trees that are going to be lost in Oak Savannah, that one of the few left on the river, or maybe the last one on the river. And they come in and they take 15 to 20 trees, as many as they can, before we hear the chainsaws and are able to get people around there. And then so they don't have confrontation with us, they leave at that point. But the trees, they just leave laying there.
This all for the largest mall in the United States?
Yeah, exactly. They're going to save 3 minutes from their trip to Minneapolis to the mall. I mean, we do need light rail in Minnesota in different areas, but not in this corridor that they picked. It's just it's a boondoggle. They've got $100 million they're paying to reroute this four-lane, 35-mile-an-hour highway when they have one right there. And there's federal laws against this, and they just shun these. When we brought them to the judges, they just dismissed us as not having the facts or something. I don't know how they go about doing these things, you know, by breaking their own laws, but they seem to be able to do it readily around here.
Well, Jimmy Anderson, I want to thank you for being with us, cultural chair of the Mendota Dakota community, fighting against the rerouting of road to the largest mall in the United States called Mall of America. Thanks for being with us as we continue to follow that struggle. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love, with help from Donna Neiman. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Our website is www.pacifica.org, and you can hear our program, if you miss any part of it, when you go to that website. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from the nation's capital. For Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
You a little problem. Not gonna take these houses for a highway. Not gonna harm one limb on these old trees.